Welcome to If Then, a show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm Will Arenas.
And I'm April Glazer. Hey everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, December 11th.
On today's show, we'll talk about the latest round of Tech CEO Goes to Washington. On Tuesday morning, that CEO was Google's Sundar Pichai, who appeared before the House Judiciary Committee, was asked about data privacy, location tracking, Google's plans in China, and of course, Republicans' favorite tech topic, conservative bias. We'll talk about what we learned from the hearing and what we wish Congress might have asked the tech CEO instead.
Then we'll be speaking with two people who have been working to organize amongst workers in Amazon fulfillment centers in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One is a founder with Awud, Nemo Omar. She's been working with the primarily East African communities that work in the Amazon warehouses there on a campaign to collectively advocate for better working conditions. We'll also be joined by a worker at one of those fulfillment centers in the Minneapolis area, William Stolz. We'll ask him about his job at the warehouse and why he's joining his fellow workers in organizing for change.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, a couple of the best things we saw online this week. That's all coming up on today's If Then.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we want to start this week with a call out to our listeners. We want to hear from you. Broadly, we're curious about how technology has impacted your life this year. So we have a couple specific questions. If you feel so moved, we'd be interested in hearing your answers. You can email us a voice memo of your response. Send that to ifthen@slate.com, and we may use your comments in an upcoming show. Or just a regular email is fine, too. You can tweet to ifthenpod if a voice memo feels like too much work.
Here are our questions. First, I want to know, has the news about Cambridge Analytica or Russian hacking or hate groups or any of the data breaches or any of the awful things that have come out about social media companies, particularly Facebook, inspired you to leave Facebook or use it differently? And if so, why and how? I want to know how the news has affected your relationship to this company that kind of is so much a part of how we communicate these days for so many people.
Second, we'd love for you to tell us about either a piece of technology you decided was essential this year or one that you decided you could live without. That would be something separate from Facebook, I guess. It could be an app, a product, or a website. But tell us why it either captivated you or the opposite of captivated you.
Again, we want you all to weigh in on these questions. To have your comments featured in an upcoming show, please email us, ifthen@slate.com. Thanks so much. We really look forward to hearing what y'all think.
All right, April, let's start with a bit of news. Tell us what's going on with Uber and Lyft this week.
Sure. Both of the ride-hailing companies did file to go public last week. Uber, once publicly traded, to be clear, could soar to a valuation of $120 billion. It's currently around $70 billion in valuation. Lyft is currently worth about $15 billion. Lyft is not as global as Uber and doesn't have as many other services, which is one of the reasons why, you know, it's not valued as highly. But yeah, these are big numbers. And, you know, these companies could signal a wave of other companies that have been holding out on going public, like Airbnb or, you know, Slack, for example, that could happen next year as well.
Yeah, it feels like it's been a while since we've had a big U.S. tech IPO, or at least a cluster of them like this. Uber was one of those companies that just was able to obtain so much money privately through venture capital that it seemed like it didn't really need to go public, at least until it really wanted to. Why do you think they're both doing it at the same time? Is that just a coincidence?
Well, it's a race, right? And so whoever goes public first is going to be the first to attract that investor money that's been hoping to cash in and get kind of investment in on the ride-hailing startup scene. And so if Lyft goes public first, then, you know, investors are going to go after Lyft first. And you know, they might capture a lot of that investor interest before Uber hits the market. And it could, you know, affect Uber's valuation later on. So it's a race to be the first to get that investor money is really what it is. But, you know, it's so interesting to see these companies, you know, talk about going public and, you know, being worth all this money, because we have to remember that they hemorrhage a ton of money. I mean, I can't stress enough, Uber is not profitable by any stretch. In just the last quarter, which is just a 3-month period, it lost over $1 billion this year. So it's definitely such a strange economy to watch and track. And, you know, I think we will see a lot of questions emerge, like what this will mean or won't mean for drivers and things like that. So something that we're certainly going to keep watching closely. And this is something that may play out in the first half of next year. And it seems like it will be a bit of a race. And, you know, Will, beyond Uber and Lyft, and I actually took a Lyft to get here, to full disclosure, right? This has become such an integral part of how we get around cities for many people.
I got here in a Lyft, too, actually, today.
Okay, there we go. And, you know, why aren't we using Uber? That's another question to ask. But we won't get into that now. I want to hear what happened this morning in Washington, D.C. Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, made his debut at a congressional hearing, right, at the House Judiciary Committee. How did that go? Is it over? Is it still going? These things can go on forever, right?
This one was mercifully short compared to some of the earlier tech hearings this year.
Nice.
So Sundar Pichai appeared today before a House committee. This was after the Senate had asked first Larry Page and then Sundar Pichai to come in September alongside Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg and Twitter's Jack Dorsey, and Google declined the invitation, or they tried to send their attorney instead. And so the Senate committee at that time went with an empty chair in Google's place, which was a pretty memorable move on their part.
I thought that was actually a really good kind of thing that the Congress did. They were addressing the empty chair, too, throughout that hearing, if I remember.
Yeah, I like that as well. But Pichai came this time, and he was very, very matter of fact in his answers and his responses. The questions from Congress ran a bit of a gamut. The most common question was from Republican lawmakers pressing Google on how it allegedly biases its product in various ways against conservatives. I didn't hear a lot of interest from conservative lawmakers in how its product might be biased against other people, which is a topic that we've talked about on If Then, when we had Professor Sophia Umoja Noble talking about how Google's search results often marginalize people who are not in positions of privilege, people of color, and other minority groups. But so Pichai did his best to sort of fend off those questions. There was one that sort of had him on the ropes, which was, that was when Republican Representative Jim Jordan was pressing him on some emails from the head of Google's multicultural marketing department talking about Google's efforts to help turn out the Latino vote. Pichai didn't seem to have the facts in front of him on that, and he wasn't able to give a persuasive response. But we've seen this again and again, where the biggest agenda of Republicans on Capitol Hill when it comes to tech is to lodge their grievances about the ways in which they feel that tech companies are downgrading conservative views or banning conservative voices or that sort of thing.
Yeah, so they're really fixated on kind of the polarizing political questions that, you know, we don't really have a lot of evidence for when it comes to, you know, claims of conservative bias. But what we have seen on Google, though, are issues with how its, you know, search algorithm does, and on YouTube rather as well, does surface, you know, conspiratorial answers to questions that, you know, any everyday person might have or student might have, whether it's about, you know, climate change or whether it's about the Holocaust. I think it was just last year or late 2016 when Google was surfacing kind of Holocaust denial answers about questions regarding the Holocaust in its search algorithm. I'm curious if things like that came up and what your sense is about how well Congress understands how search works, because, you know, we did see some uninformed questions questioning Mark Zuckerberg. But my sense is that Congress probably understands social media a bit better than it understands search. And I understand social media more than search because, you know, you have to have some literacy to use social media. Search is kind of a black box.
Yeah, I think collectively the Facebook scandals have educated us all a little bit better about how social media works and how the algorithms work and all that sort of thing. And you're right, I think that has probably happened less so with Google search, to the point that Pichai at one point was trying to explain to one of his conservative interlocutors why searching idiot on Google might turn up Donald Trump's name in the search results. He like had to walk through why that, how that could happen without some liberal at Google intentionally programming it to tie the word idiot to Donald Trump. But yeah, there was one question about a bias that we have seen a lot of evidence for over the past couple of years, which is in YouTube's algorithm. It's the bias toward extremism. And you know, you kind of go down these rabbit holes. You ask a question like, you know, about Americans landing on the moon, and the next thing you know, you've got like flat earth videos and all these kind of wild conspiracy videos. And Pichai did not have this. The question was from Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland. Pichai did not have a good answer. He gave this sort of anodyne response about how, you know, well, with our growth comes responsibility. We're committed to doing better. I mean, he basically just didn't have an answer. And he was able to get away with that because that wasn't at the top of Congress's agenda in this particular session.
You know, finally, I'm curious about whether or not any members of Congress expressed interest in antitrust or limiting Google's power by kind of limiting the stranglehold it has on so many aspects of, you know, the internet market.
Yeah, I didn't hear a ton of interest from Congress in antitrust questions, but there was definitely one person at the hearing who was very interested in that. There was this activist who attends congressional hearings dressed as the Monopoly mascot, you know, Rich Uncle Pennybags.
Yeah,
for
sure.
With the top hat and the mustache. And this person, I guess their name is Ian Madrigal, they sat right behind Pichai, so you could see them on TV and on the live stream. They started out with one mustache, and then the mustache got bigger. Then the mustaches started multiplying. So anybody watching, then there was a veiled reference to Google being a monopoly there, but there wasn't a lot of serious discussion of antitrust matters.
That's too bad, because, you know, when I think about Google, I think about all the companies that are kind of under the umbrella when it comes to Google Docs, when it, or not companies, but components, right, where like they're the go-to default thing that everybody uses. Gmail, Android, X, which is kind of spun out under Alphabet. But there's so many divisions under Alphabet that seems like, you know, would be ripe for kind of separating in some way. And the thing that kind of brings so many of the products at Google together is that they share the massive amount of data that Google collects on its users from both, you know, using search and then we put our queries into Google, but also from Gmail and shopping and all kinds of stuff that we do across the web. And I'm curious what Congress said about privacy. Were there questions about Google's data collection? So we do not have an overarching privacy law or a suite of privacy laws like they do in Europe that were passed this year.
There actually were some questions about privacy. Some of them sharper than others. There were a couple of them that really gave fodder to critics of Congress for mockery. One of them, we can play a clip for you. It was from Representative Ted Poe, a Republican from Texas, and he was really intent on grilling Pichai and just nailing him down on this question of whether Google is tracking him around the room on his phone. And so he was being very dramatic about it and saying, it's either yes or no. It's not a trick question.
So Google knows that I am moving over there. It's not a trick question. You know, you make $100 million a year, you ought to be able to answer that question. Does Google know through this phone that I am moving over there and sit next to Mr. Johnson, which would make him real nervous? It's his question. It's yes or no.
I wouldn't be able to answer without looking at...
You can't say yes or no.
Without knowing more details, sir.
Pichai couldn't give an answer, and the reason is because Representative Poe has an iPhone. It's not a Google phone. So Sundar Pichai couldn't answer his question without knowing what Google software is installed on that phone, because obviously Google does not make the iPhone.
So that definitely gave Pichai an easy out on that very kind of important question, actually. And I wish that he didn't just punt that to the obvious mistake that the congressperson made, but you know, earnestly answered in the framing that he would be able to answer it in, as if it was a question about Android.
Yeah, I would have liked him to answer that earnestly, too, because the truth is Google probably is tracking a lot of us, even if we have an iPhone, because we have Google Apps on it, of course. There was a much better framed question from Representative Ted Deutsch of Texas. But the irony was, he spent so much time specifying the question that by the time Pichai gave an evasive answer, he had no time to follow up. And so that was just kind of left hanging as well.
Yeah, sometimes these hearings can get kind of operatic if you let the kind of confusion from Congress all kind of blur together and just take it as one large movement. But yeah, it sounds like it went about as expected and not necessarily something that's going to lead to policy change, but hopefully something that will lead to more questioning of this very powerful company in the future.
One thing that I wrote about in my Slate piece on the hearings today is that this kind of inchoate confusion for members of Congress, it's easy to dismiss or laugh at, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, this is how a lot of Americans feel. They don't know exactly how companies like Google and Facebook are compromising their privacy, but they know it's probably happening. And the confusion leads to frustration, and it could lead to outrage and a demand for something to be done. So I could actually see some of these confused congresspeople slowly coming around to supporting legislation, if nothing else, that forces Google to explain what it is doing. You know, GDPR-type legislation that requires tech companies to do a better job of explaining exactly what data they're collecting and making sure that customers really understand what they're opting into.
You know, asks for transparency have been bipartisan in the past, so this might be something that we could see some organizing around.
Yeah, I am more optimistic than I have been in previous hearings that there is going to be movement on this eventually.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have my interview with labor organizer Nemo Omar and Amazon worker William Stolz.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Complaints from workers at Amazon fulfillment centers and from delivery staff have been brewing for years. But this year, as Amazon continues to take leading roles in multiple industries beyond online retail, like cloud hosting and streaming video, and by national chains like Whole Foods, and its owner has risen to become the richest man in the world, there's been an increased focus on the working conditions in the fulfillment centers that are key to Amazon's Prime subscription program, which allows most all orders to be delivered to one's address within 2 days. That speedy shipping arrangement has led to troubling reports of harsh conditions at Amazon's more than 110 fulfillment centers across the country. According to a new report from the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, at least 9 workers have died working at Amazon facilities since 2013. There have been reports of Amazon warehouse workers and delivery drivers urinating in bottles for fear of taking breaks, penalization for taking sick days, and the use of digital trackers that time how long it takes each employee to do each task measured down to the second. Amazon itself this year has distributed training materials to managers to discourage unionization. And during Black Friday weekend, workers in fulfillment centers in Spain and Germany protested their working conditions, and multiple strikes are planned for this month. Our guests today are Nemo Omar and William Stolz. Nemo Omar is a co-founder of the Awud Center, an organization whose mission is to build economic and political power amongst workers in the East African communities of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And William Stolz works at one of the Amazon fulfillment centers in the Minneapolis area. He's been organizing with his colleagues at the Awud Center, where Amazon has sat down at the table with organized workers and has started to compromise and negotiate on some of their asks. Nemo and William, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with some quick background. Nemo, you helped found the Awud Center in 2017. Can you tell us a bit about what Awud is and why y'all formed? And is the campaign amongst Amazon employees your first campaign?
Awesome. Yes. So the Awud Center was founded in 2017. It's a community organization whose mission is to build economic and political power amongst workers in the East African community. And yeah, so Amazon is also a campaign or a company that we've been helping workers advocate and talk about some of their issues at the workplace.
Okay. And William, tell us a bit about where you work and what you do there. How long have you been at an Amazon warehouse? And are you a contractor for Amazon or do you work directly for Amazon?
No, I'm a direct hire. Most of the people in my warehouse are direct hires. we just have temps right now for the holidays. But I've been there about a year and a half. I'm an order picker, and basically that means that so the merchandise is out on these storage pods, and a robot brings it to my station, and I have to grab an item in a certain number of seconds, put it in a tote, and send it down the line to the packing area.
Right. So you're really timed closely. And I want to get into that. Nemo, maybe you could tell us a bit about some of the gripes that have caused people to start to organize and talk amongst themselves at the worker center.
I've been doing this work for about a year and a half as well, and starting in June last year. We've been having a lot of communications with workers in the community, East African folks in particular, about mistreatment and concerns at these warehouses. I remember last year there was a bus that used to shuttle folks from Minneapolis. And, you know, when Amazon moved into Minnesota, they wanted workers to come to these warehouses, and all of a sudden they've, you know, discontinued this bus. And a lot of folks were super upset about this. And William is actually was one of the workers, and they've started a 200 worker petition, and they signed it and they sent to Jeff Bezos in Seattle. There's also other issues around subcontractor workers that were driving vans in Egan. We had a case with a East African worker. His name is Daniel Baye, who was subcontracted to deliver packages for Amazon. And he, you know, was missing about 2 weeks of work of wages, and he didn't get that back. And so he contacted our office, and we got in contact and, you know, started to help him and figure out what was going on. He's among other workers that were missing some wages at the subcontracted companies. And so after weeks of, you know, protest and just, sending letters to these subcontractor companies that were working for Amazon, he won hundreds of dollars in payback after fighting. And so in the path of doing this work, we've met workers like William, who's been outspoken, Hibak, who's another outspoken worker, and who's also been featured in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago. And so workers are, you know, talking and having conversations about what's going on in these warehouses, and they want to make sure that Amazon listens to them and make sure that these things change for the better so that they can still continue to work and feed their families.
Right. William, tell me about this petition that you started. How did you kind of get this off the ground? Were you communicating on the buses? I mean, where were you able to kind of start to communicate with folks outside of the workday to get this? And what was the petition for?
Well, I should clarify, it wasn't just me,
sure.
But I was definitely, upset when they got rid of that old bus, just because that was the whole reason I got this job, not having a car myself. But yeah, it just started a lot of conversations, started getting people thinking about, like, you know, here's this, you know, very like tangible issue. Like, we used to have, you know, great transportation to work. And the other problem too is they cut it just before the winter of last year. And so people were concerned about safety. I mean, Amazon replaced it with, by paying this other bus company to add an Amazon stop to their route, but overall the same trip takes twice as long. But anyway, yeah, it just, started conversations among workers about, this one particular issue in the workplace that seemed like, you know, pretty easy to support. But then, there are many other, you know, issues that people deal with day to day in the workplace. Like, you know, as far as myself and, you know, when I talk to the rest of my coworkers, the number one thing that most people seem to be concerned about is the scan rates. And so, like I said before, when I have to pick an item, I have to do that in a certain number of seconds and get a certain number of items per hour. And so the items per hour, that's the rate. And almost every department has a rate that, you know, always, like, just over the long term, always goes up, never goes down. And so they keep pushing people farther and farther. You know, the consequences of that is that, you know, just the time that I've been there, I've, you know, seen lots of friends of mine get injured. And, you know, my warehouse, like, it skews younger just because, you know, the work is so physically demanding. But even people who are, you know, in their, you know, 20s and 30s, you know, getting the kinds of injuries having to worry about pain in knees and shoulders and things like that, where people shouldn't have to be dealing with that so young, you know?
Yeah. And so how was it being addressed before? I mean, or let me step back. Has Amazon been kind of demanding higher rates of productivity amongst amongst its workers? Have you seen more demands coming from Amazon to y'all? And have they just not been addressing the kind of, you know, workplace health concerns that people have brought up? How have they been addressing that? And have you seen more them trying to squeeze more work out of people?
So the first... the first time there were a lot of us workers coming together to raise concerns to management about rate was around Ramadan this past summer. So so my warehouse, there are a lot of Somali Muslim workers, or, you know, same with the other Amazon warehouse in Minnesota, and so warehouses in Minnesota. And so, if people don't know, when you're celebrating Ramadan, people like fast all day long, no eating, no drinking, even water, up until, I believe, until the sun goes down. And so you're still doing this very physically demanding job, having to meet these, you know, very fast rates. And so we, you know, a bunch of workers and some people who are involved in the bus, some not, just coming together around the, like, issues around Ramadan, just demanding like a lower rate, like some time off for people to celebrate the Eid, the big holiday at the end with their families, and a nicer place to pray. And, you know, management's response was that the rate is the rate and that's the way it is. But we did end up pushing them to, so now there's a place where on Fridays men pray.
And, you know, Nemo, I'm curious, one of the things that about this organizing effort is that there has been reports of this being kind of a tight-knit and very large community of East African immigrants that are working at these warehouses. Has that been kind of part of the success of organizing in that, you know, there's already kind of a community amongst the workers that are outside of work?
Right. Yes. Yeah. So, our main so I'm an East African, I'm Somali, I'm an East African woman, and so, yes, a lot of the workers that do work at these warehouses and at Amazon are on, a lot of majority of them, not majority of them, but a lot of, like, a huge number makes up an East African community folks. And so what we were, what we've been able to do is basically uplift their voices and advocate and empower folks at these warehouses to understand that you do have rights to talk about certain things like religious accommodation, speaking your language when you're at the workplace. If you feel like you've been discriminated, like what does that mean? And so we've been able to, in the last year and a half, we've had multiple Know Your Rights training so that so the workers understand that their rights at the workplace and that it's okay to talk about these things outside of work. We do run our meetings in Somali and also in English. We have an interpretation as well for workers that don't speak Somali.
Has there been an issue with, you know, some workers who maybe primarily speak Somali having a difficult time communicating at work because there aren't perhaps managers that speak Somali at these warehouses, even though there is a large amount of workers that that speak that language primarily? Has that been an issue?
Instances, so we've had workers that, I'm not sure if there's been an action in Egan that happened in Ramadan. So it happened this year during the summer. And a lot of the workers, you know, protested because there were, you know, really bad working conditions, like heating wise, people fainting because they, you know, they couldn't drink water and they're working extremely hard. And one of the demands, and one of the things that workers actually uplifted was, hey, there's a lot of, you know, East African workers that work in this place, but there's no management or there's nobody that can translate between these workmen. And one win that workers are really happy about is that they've hired someone who can full-time I'm not sure about the time, but they've hired someone to translate and take surveys and kind of, you know, meet with them and talk with them. They've also put a TV in the break room that's in English and Somali to translate some of the stuff, new updates. And so even talking to workers, some workers feel that there needs to be change when it comes to hiring as well. A lot of our, in our management meetings with Amazon, workers have uplifted and talked about that we need to see diversity and reflective of like the East African workers inside the buildings as well. And I know William can speak on more about hiring and promoting, but a lot of workers do talk about that there needs to be some kind of level of interaction with the community to support the needs of these workers.
Right, so they can communicate. And to be clear, the organizing that's happening here isn't a union, right? This is a group working with Awood, which is a nonprofit worker center, and kind of generally organizing around the large East African communities in the area and other workers who are with Amazon there. And you guys are helping workers to organize and make collective demands, but, you know, not as a union. And Amazon's been known to be anti-union and distribute materials to managers to help give them tools to discourage organizing. I'm curious, has Amazon refused to meet with you all or discouraged the organizing in any way? You know, this is to either of you, Nemo or William.
Amazon's approach has, for the most part, been, sending managers to talk with workers, say like, hey, if you have a problem, just, bring it to us. You don't have to, you don't have to go someplace else. You don't, now in recent weeks, like, oh, you don't have to protest. But I mean, the thing is, it's like, they can say that, and if they say like, oh, don't, just bring your problems to management, bring your problems to HR. I mean, if the issue is you want a lower rate, well, I mean, what are you going to do? Like, we had two big meetings with Amazon upper management for Minnesota back in September and end of October. Where we talked about, the issues at Amazon, things we wanted changed, when it comes to like, rate, unfair write-ups, unfair firings, injuries, guaranteeing time off for Muslim religious holidays, investment in the community. And, and we haven't gotten a good response from them on, any of the, big substantial issues that we brought up. They've made some, some adjustments, but, nothing addressing the core issues. And so, that's why we're gearing up for, a protest on December 14th, but, yeah, I mean, like, they keep saying like, oh, just come talk to us. And it's like, we did,
Right. And so, Nima, what are some of the core issues that are not being addressed?
So William was talking about, we've met with the management and we facilitated, we've had workers, in these meetings with the upper management of Amazon in Minnesota. And workers were basically talking about creating a humane rate and workload. So ending also kind of the unfair write-ups folks are getting. There's a lot of folks talk about firings as well, unfair firings that happen inside the buildings. Folks also mentioned that there needs to be some kind of guarantee and that like employee and community concerns are heard and taken seriously by local management. A lot of folks over the year have mentioned as well that Amazon needs to respect the cultures of, the East African and Muslim workers. There's also an issue about workers, being penalized for prayer breaks, and there's this thing called TOT, time off task. So if you're at your station working and, you step aside, they will, deduct some, your rate will go lower because you've stepped away from your station. And that's something a lot of workers have mentioned as well in our meetings and also at this in between management between the Amazon worker meeting and management meeting in September and October.
And so what do you guys hope to get out of this December 14th action? This is going to be a walkout or a protest. What do you hope to get out of it?
So some of the workers who are going to be there that day will be working and then walking out, but we'll have others who are showing up separately. We're really hoping that Amazon makes some movement on these demands. Like, you know, the biggest one is, you know, being the rate that they just keep pushing our, you know, pushing our bodies and our minds, you know, to the limits, like psychologically, like that does something mm-hmm. to you when you gotta, you know, go every 7 seconds. But we also want to show the other workers who are feeling the same way, but who are afraid to speak out, that, you know, that we've got, you know, a lot of community support behind us. You know, there are going to be other people coming who are not Amazon workers, but just want to support workers. And, you know, like I said, I mean, we had these meetings with management and they weren't making the kinds of changes we want to see. So, you know, workers took a vote and we voted to take action.
Right. And Nemo, for you now, finally, I'm curious, has this been a scary prospect, particularly for, you know, people who you work with who are immigrants or have come to the U.S. as refugees and maybe are worried about pushing back against, you know, a job?
So it's been a battle. It's been an uphill battle. And there's been a lot of victories and a lot of successes within this campaign for a year and a half. In the beginning stage, it was extremely hard. It was kind of like beating against a wall. Like, the folks were not understanding, like, wait, you can speak up. There's this huge barrier of, like, you know, this is an authority, like, you can't speak up, you know, against this, you know, there's going to be some backlash, you're going to get fired for it. And what we've been able to do is, you know, hold these, you know, trainings and raise awareness around workplace rights. And so due time, you know, folks were understanding, hey, I can speak up. Actually, one of our, you know, leaders was saying, I used to be a kind of guy, used to like stay quiet and never used to say anything. But now that I've been involved with the Awards Center, I'm able to stand up and speak out. And so what we've learned is that, you know, it takes time, but we've learned that, you know, this is a community was Black, predominantly like a Black Muslim community, immigrant, some, you know, folks, refugees who are new to the country. A lot of our core members and core leaders are actually have been here not more than 2 years. And so being in a different country, not knowing the language strongly, and the one thing that really, you know, makes me proud of doing this work is that when I hear them say, you know, we've left a war-torn country, we've traveled, we've migrated, and we've come to a different country, but we're here to also stand up for our rights and make sure that the other Amazonians and other people in this country know that we're not just, you know, pushovers. We're here to make change. And that really gives me hope to see, like, you know, a marginalized community that's overlooked, like, over and over again in this country is, like, you know, doing the most, like, amazing work in our times and demanding from, like, almost a trillion dollar company. So it's amazing and it's super moving to see this community do the work.
Yes, and to call attention to the work that goes behind so many of the online orders that are amassing now ahead of holiday season. Really exciting to watch and look forward to continuing to follow this story. Nemo Omar and William Stolz, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, one final quick break, then we'll have Will back for Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we've seen on the web this week.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
What is the one most important thing our society needs?
That would be harsher punishment for parole violators, Stan. And world peace.
Okay, we get it. World peace might seem like a pipe dream. But what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Will, what tab could you not close this week?
My tab comes from the Pew Research Center, and this was a report that came out on Monday, and the headline was, "Social Media Outpaces Print Newspapers in the U.S. as a News Source." Now, I don't know what kind of surprise that might come as to people. I think some people would probably be surprised that social media is now more widely used as a news source than print. Some people might be surprised that it didn't happen a long time ago because we've been talking so much about the influence of social media on the news. But this is an important question. I think there's a widely cited stat about, like, you know, 50% of Americans get news from social media, but that's just people who say they ever get news. This is asking a different question, which is, do you regularly get news from this medium? And the percentage now for social media is about 20% of U.S. adults saying they regularly turn to it for news. Only 16% of U.S. adults now say they turn to print newspapers for news on a regular basis. So that industry its slow death is proceeding apace. The biggest medium is still television, but that's come down from 57% to 49%. April, I know you often talk about how we underrate TV news as an influential news source. It is still the primary one for most Americans. And then below that, news websites at 33%, which I guess is good news for Slate, and radio at 26%.
One thing I'll say on this briefly is that, like, okay, that's how many people turn to radio for news, but something like over 90% of Americans, you know, in their teens and adults, listen to radio every week. It's one of the most penetrating mediums, and same for local television and television in general. And so, you know, I so interesting, and I just also want to be sure we realize how these mediums are used in other ways beyond news consumption, and how, like, penetrating traditional media forms are that aren't the internet. But that's a really interesting study. For my tab this week, I have a new long form piece from music writer Liz Pelly. It's called Streambait Pop, and it's in The Baffler. And it's really interesting. I'm in the middle of reading it because it just came out today. But it is about the homogenization of music that has occurred under streaming services and the attention economy, and how when songs are kind of created to be placed in playlists as opposed to be kind of full albums or packages that artists can sell, but rather created to be streamed, what that's done to music, and arguing that it's kind of homogenized music, that it's made a lot of music sound the same. One quote I want to read: musical trends produced in the streaming area are inherently connected to attention, whether it's hard and fast attention-grabbing hooks, pop drops, and chorus loops engineered for the pleasure centers of our brains, or music that strategically requires no attention at all, the background music, the emotional wallpaper, the chill pop sad vibe playlist fodder. These sounds and strategies all have stream bait tricks embedded within them. Whether they aim to wedge bits of a song into our skulls or just angle toward the inoffensive and mood-specific enough to prevent users from clicking away. All of this caters to an economy of clicks and completions, where the most precious commodity is polarized human attention, either amped up or zoned out, where success is determined almost in advance by data. And basically, it's just the argument that kind of the attention economy is homogenizing art. And it's about how the structure through which we listen to and patronize the arts in drastically changes that art. And the economics behind that changes that art. And so I look forward to finishing it. I'm almost done. But I think it's really important that we critically look at how the economics of how we consume, you know, creativity invariably changes and morphs that and perhaps even dampens it.
Yeah, I agree. It's important to look critically about how the attention economy shapes art. I will say I have a lot of confidence in artists to in the long run, resist homogenization. I mean, this is what artists are good at, is fighting back against homogenization. So I have no doubt we'll see the backlash to this as well.
But this is about, like, what becomes popular and what's served to us. And kind of when we hand over the picking of music that we listen to playlists and to algorithmic curators, right? Like, what's being served to us? Is it the lowest common denominator that everybody is most likely to enjoy, right? Or something like that. And
right. And this term stream bait pop, I'm not sure if this article coined it or if it's been coined before, but I think it's specifically referring to like a subgenre of music that's designed not to distract you, right? When you start streaming it on Spotify, it's going to be as inoffensive as it can so that you don't want to change it and thus rob the artist of the money they get for each completed listen.
Right. Or is this all music that's we're supposed to be able to work to at our computers, at our desks alone, right? Music that kind of facilitates our own attention capture and our lack of kind of socializing in music and going out and listening to more difficult, interesting things. Are we all kind of being channeled in a certain way to listen to art in a certain way? And so I look forward to finish reading this. I do recommend people pick it up as well. I've really enjoyed what I've read so far. And guys, we have one extra tiny tap from our producer, Max. We love it when he has something to share. Max, what do you have open on your computer screen, on your web browser this week?
Well, since we're talking about art and technology, I had to jump in. Have either of you seen the new movie Roma?
No, but it's one of the few new movies that I've actually heard about. So what is
I basically
it?
Never get to see new yeah. movies, so no. Also, no.
I just have to read a lot. That's my job.
So it's a new movie by Alfonso Cuarón, the director who did Gravity,
right.
Children of Men, Y Tu Mama También.
I really want to see this movie then.
Yeah. Well, and so it's really interesting. Netflix, it's a Netflix movie, and it's coming out on Netflix later this week. But part of the deal in order to get Oscar buzz and such was they agreed to put it out in theaters for a short time. So it's out right now, and I saw it, and it just... If you're able to go see it, if you can afford to go see it, I highly recommend going to see it in theaters. So I'm actually recommending you close the tab entirely, go to the movie theater. You can watch it later on Netflix, but at least once, if you can, experience it in theaters. It's like such a beautiful movie, and I was, was very moved by it. So that's my recommendation.
Oh, I'm excited for a film recommendation. Yeah, I think I will check it out. Thanks, Max. And that actually does it for our show this week. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod.
You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. This is the part where I usually say send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, just say hi. But actually, I'm going to go back to our earlier call. Send us your answer to those questions that we asked earlier. We would love to hear from you and potentially feature your response on our show.
Yeah, share with us what you think. You can follow me and Will on Twitter. I'm at April Laser and Will is at Will Oremus.
And thanks to everyone who has left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or whatever other platform you use to listen. We really appreciate your time.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is the wonderful Max Jacobs. And thanks to Cody Hamilton for engineering here in Berkeley, California.
Thanks to Nick Holmes at Occupy Studio in Newark, Delaware. We'll see you next week.
Bye, guys.